Ah mais c'est la même.
The thing is that how the my interest in the musical dimension is basically, you know, if you take everyday urban life, how are all of these seemingly individualized trajectories of movement and circulation, how are they held together somehow? What is it? You talked about this choreography of movement, of, and in retrospect or at a distance, it's possible to map that out. You know, you can draw it, you can film it, you can analyze the way in which all of these different bodies and materials seem to work together or not work together. I mean, there are conflicts, there are misunderstandings, there are antagonisms, there are breakdowns, there are glitches all of the time. Things don't unfold in a kind of seamless, invisible order. It's not the invisible hand of the market that is, you know, moving us along with each other. And so what is it? Well, it's not one thing, you know. It's that's the point. It's not one thing. It's not our simple adherence to, I mean, somehow the infrastructure of the city, its layout, its roads, its pathways, its conduits, its openings, its enclosures, its interruptions, they all tell us something about how to move and where to move. But it's not sufficient in terms of trying to account for the kind of overall, if there is an overall. I'm not even sure if there's an overall. You know, maybe it is simply a kind of dance of multiple fragments. And that the dance has to find a way to somehow relate to other dances all the time. But it is a kind of sense, a bit something that's rhythmic. It is something that is in some sense polyrhythmic. Again, the question is, what do we pay attention to? And so so music, particularly sort of improvisational music, is a way of exploring those kinds of different sort of rhythmic, those compositional structures that I think are at work in composing all of the different kinds of movements and circulations that not only we are engaged with, but circulations of materials, circulations of flows, circulations of... And it enables us to somehow feel that, have an effective sense of that. I mean, that's one thing. The other thing is why is there a kind of, in a lot of cities, a kind of constant soundscape, you know, where you do hear music all of the time, or a lot of the time. And increasingly something that's more privatized is people have their own sound systems that are not shared, you know. And that also says something about the way in which there's a much more individualized, privatized kind of affective and economic relationship to urban spaces and urban living. Whereas in some urban contexts, the constant infusion of music on the streets or from windows or houses or the kinds of, and oftentimes the very competing sound systems, which are sometimes difficult to bear because there's so many of them and they're playing such radically different types of music, but yet are a way of trying to sculpt the kind of atmosphere through which we are attempting to move and to feel and to see and to engage. What are the kinds of factors at work that enable us to see things, to open ourselves up enough to pay attention to what other people are doing and how they're doing what they're doing, or even just the factness of other lives as they are? Of course, we can't pay attention to everything. We can't make everyone relevant to what it is that we feel or what it is that we may or may not do. But it is the sort of modality of sound that in some ways does curate and instigate and open us up to a particular kind of engagement with the urban surrounds, which I think is in some sense then what is one of the important things about because everyday life is rhythmic. It's how we move, how we walk, where we put ourselves in relationship to each other, I mean, think of where your bodies are on a daily basis. Where are they? How many different places? How many different positions? How many different sequences? And with what kinds of people? With who? All of that is a rhythm. All of that is a kind of rhythm. That sequencing is a rhythm. And sometimes we adhere to very similar kinds of rhythms without thinking about it. And we only pay attention to it when our world is rocked in some ways by unexpected events or occurrences or surprises that we are able to pay attention to exactly how much our everyday living is in some sense rhythmic. And this is evident when you take a city of 18 million people that oftentimes has electricity for maybe 1 or 2 hours a day, where oftentimes water doesn't run, oftentimes where people are stuck in traffic for 5-6 hours every day to and from work. Where there's little recourse to whatever in terms of things if things go wrong. There you really begin to see the extent to which the rhythmic structures and sequences of bodies and what they can and cannot do with each other play a major part in terms of getting people from one day to the next. If you have to wait in line, at a water pump for several hours, what do? Sometimes you leave your bucket there, you pay a kid to watch it, but otherwise you're in this wait, you're in this line. Well, what is it that you do with that line? Do you stand there silently, or do people begin to use that as an opportunity in which to do something with it that is in some ways both sometimes ritualistic, you know, where, and it's largely the responsibility of women to do it, where this is where women will talk about, share what goes on in their households, get advice, gossip. Or if there's something coming, if there's something, there's a feeling like something's coming, is this the opportunity for those women to then somehow collectively prepare for that sense of something that is coming? It's all about composition. It's all about sort of the capacity to improvise that composition, to try to maximize the most of what you can make from a particular kind of situation. Or on the other hand, to minimize the exposure or the vulnerability or the insecurity that might be entailed in something that you have to do. We all know that in many cities, you know, for women that have to work late at night, for them to have to even navigate the city, it's a major deal. There's always the sort of threat of exposure in a way in which there's little recourse sometimes to being protected. So what kinds of rhythms are entailed in trying to maximize both opportunity and to minimize untoward exposure to things? How many times do people change up their routines? Not walk the same way home more than two, three times.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
In the context of wars, what if we keep the same thinking of the appropriation of space, and how, which point we should consider more that we can appropriate our space, because it's not like our space anymore. It's the space. It's not. It's like bombarded, or it's by the other country, or like it's difficult to have our own space. It's difficult to have the same.
On a daily basis.
Yeah, to have a daily basis like a normal human being, which is living safe.
No, it's a good question. You know, I mean, in a really crowded neighborhood where everyone potentially can be in each other's business, where there's no apparent sense of privacy, where everything seems to be occupied, where there seems to be eyes everywhere, where do people go to have sex? This oftentimes is a mystery to not only outside observers, it's a mystery to the residents that live in the very same place itself. I've been part of household conversations where family members are just bewildered about a kind of a pregnancy that, you know, they will claim to have been a virgin birth because they could see no possibility where this person could have had any opportunity to have sex anywhere. It's just beyond their imagination. But much less than that, I mean, there is this question about, yeah, I mean, where can you go? What can you do? Under what circumstances? And who decides that? And usually, I mean, conventionally, these kinds of things are worked out through the notion of property. Property has always been the sort of techne, not always, but it's been in sort of contemporary urbanization, the techne through which these questions are decided. about who belongs where, who can have what kinds of rights over what kind of space, under what kinds of circumstances. The problem with property is basically because in some ways that property also always entails that you have to do something with it. I mean, most urban regulations are that if you have a piece of land within a kind of designated urban area, you have to develop it, or else you lose the rights to it. So you have to make something. But this goes back to always the point about property is not just, it's not just about possession, but it's possession with the obligation to have to do something with it. Something which amplifies its separateness from everything else. But the problem with the notion of that separateness is that that separateness isn't really separate. It's the illusion of separateness. Because in some ways you can't have a territory, you can't have a piece of land that is separate from something else. The very survival and sustenance of anything that is considered separate depends on a kind of larger ecology of material flows and interactions and relationships. But we're so ingrained with the notion of property that in some ways property is what we treat ourselves as. We are in constant need of development. You know, we can't sort of sit still. We can't be satisfied with who it is that we are. We always have to get more education or more training or have more tweets or have more likes or be on more Instagram posts. We have to constantly announce ourselves. We have to constantly talk about what it is that we are and constantly treat ourselves as property to be developed. And the more we do that, the more we amplify that, the more we detract from the ways in which that sense of separateness is just a kind of illusion in some ways. That really we're all part of a kind of larger ecology of relationships that we depend on in order so much of urban economy now is invested in terms of trying to prop up that notion of separateness. I mean, what COVID did was to amplify that. You know, you can now order anything online. You never have to leave your house. You can just order. You can work from home, work online, order from line, have friends online, have sex online. You never have to go out into the world. The way in which that kind of sense of property and separateness is buttressed as a kind of locus of urban economic development. But the more we do that, then the more there are going to be these kinds of conflicts about who belongs where and how and to whom. Which is why in some sense the tendency has been to try to mitigate all of the efforts, particularly among sort of poor urban residents, to appropriate land, to appropriate a space, to take a space. All this sort of emphasis on NGOs and sort of progressive urban politics, which is in some ways to regularize, you know, to regularize people's possibility to have a kind of secure emplacement. Not because we're really interested in providing a kind of secure livelihood, but we want to sort of mitigate as much as possible those kinds of acts of appropriation. And so much of that takes place in some ways behind, you know, behind in ways. things which are in some ways more invisible. The ways, for example, in Sarcelle, where in sort of old HLMs that are barely hanging on, where residents inside will appropriate space and reconstitute it away from the kind of design of apartment 4G, 4H, 4J, that redesigned the space to allow a different kind of collective sentiment to develop. Or the way in which movements in Athens or in Rome attempt to reappropriate. You were talking about ruins before, you know, older factories, older wasted zones that are, and somehow find within that kind of process of disuse a kind of way of taking space and doing something else, and doing something else with it. But the question I think you're asking a really very different question than how I'm responding to you.
Yes.
Which is in sort of like day to day. I mean, how is it that you can circumvent the kind of capture that you are placed in terms of who are you and where does it allow, what kind of movements and spaces does that make you eligible to be in, or to announce yourself, or to do something within? In cities where the regimes of property are more intense than ever before, where the degrees of spatial segregation are much more marked. Where the economic survival of cities doesn't necessarily mean a kind of consensus on the part of its citizens, or an attempt to at least act as if somewhere there is this kind of... And the way in which public space itself is increasingly commercialized and made into a kind of economic object to be invested in, and where a public is displayed in some ways, curated as a consuming public that consumes the space and under the auspices of somehow a kind of public enactment. I think we're moving a long way away from that. You know? I mean, look how people navigate every day in the streets. You know, it's sort of like, you know, I used to, in the old days, I started my career as a kind of, in psychiatry. And, you know, nowadays you walk on the street, you see people, all these people talking to themselves. You know, in the old days you used to worry about their mental health, you know. Now it's just they're talking on the cell phone without looking like they're talking on the cell phone. They're simply engaged in a kind of private conversation. In my neighborhood, it is rare that anyone is on the street without talking on the cell phone while being on the street. It is rare. That's really fucked up in many ways, because in some ways you just are extending the notion of the private space into the public along all these multiple different trajectories of privacy where... You know, when you ride the metro, you know, who listens to each other? You know, it used to be great, you know, in the old days, riding the subway, you'd hear all kinds of weird conversations and, you know, lovers whispering to each other and other people arguing and other people talking about really inane, banal things, but you had a sense of what they were about. There was a kind of mutual appropriation of people's lives in some ways. People taking something from each other. Not that they agreed to do it, it just was the reality of that kind of moment of density. But now we sort of separate that out into these kinds of parallel play in some ways, that you know, we don't pay attention to each other.
So it's not jazz.
Huh?
It's not jazz.
No, it's not jazz at all. I mean,
jazz is to be today.
Yeah.
And to play today. There's no jazz.
But in order to do
jazz, this music, but it's not jazz.
Yeah. But I mean, in order to do that, I mean, jazz requires an inordinate attunement to, you know, an inordinate way of paying attention to each other and anticipating, you know, again, anticipating that what might be that next move. And even if you anticipate wrong, you know how to quickly move with that kind of misanticipation.
Some of the questions about.
Faut que tu parles plus fort.
Ah, ok. I have a question about this unsettlement that in reality is very resilient, almost. Is that it? Like the unsettlement is resilient, like it allows you to be more prepared to changement, moving, and. How does it affect the endurance that you talked to before? Yes. This I don't know how to formulate this.
Et dis-le en français, donc.
Ah, ok. Non, je trouve que d'endurance, c'est toujours se déplacer, bouger et ne pas se. Si on restait à un endroit, et voilà comment j'avais cette endurance, surtout à l'époque avec les locations de loyer, tu payes toujours pour être à un endroit, t'as pas de. Je sais pas, toutes ces questions-là, je sais pas comment ça fait.
You understand or?
Help me out.
It's about endurance and how you deal with all the situations you have to face. In terms of renting a place, for instance, and have to rent another one, c'est ça? And all this, it's really about how you can keep dealing constantly with all the situation you have to face. So basically, I understand it as really a question about what is the notion of endurance. Ça te va? Okay.
I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with sort of the changing manifestations and not so much logics, but the changing manifestations of power. You know, capital is very resilient, and in some ways in many sort of urban core central city areas of the world, these are not places of inhabitation. They're not places of apparent use. They're concretizations of the resilience of capital to always in some ways change course, always to put things in touch with each other in a different way. Across vast kinds of, across different geographies, across different kinds of, there's always this sense of resilience as a kind of form of arbitrage, you know, taking minor differences and playing those differences off against each other. The way in which the sort of increasingly the economic underpinnings of urban life have to do with financial calculations, speculations on the future, and it doesn't matter what that future is. You invest in multiple dispositions of that. If A happens, you bet on that, and you bet on B, and you bet on multiple futures. And if one happens and one not, it really doesn't matter. The way in which oftentimes developers will, of big projects, whether they're industrial projects, whether real estate projects, will often tell me, It doesn't matter what happens now, it's the eventuality that something will happen. We're doing this not for the profitability of the moment. We're doing that eventually we will find a way to make this work. So that resilience is in some ways the very core of the changeability, the ability of so it's not like, it's not any longer cities making specific things or producing specific things. It's rather the way in which the city is positioned in a multiplicity of different kinds of calculative relationships in terms of differential value, you know. Well, if that's the case, then increasingly we are more and more expendable. I mean, where did capital learn this? Capital, in part, learned this from the very practices and logics of the majority of residents who had to make a life in the city by virtue of being resilient. In a process which I often call Grand Theft Auto, that is, the process of auto construction, of people making a kind of urban life for themselves by being able to be resilient. For example, I know markets where, you know, the markets will suddenly appear at night out of nowhere. Hundreds and hundreds of stalls. And that these markets are the kind of critical supply for all the local markets across the urban region. And you have people who are the drivers of the trucks, the people who are the sellers, the people who are the cleaners, the people who collect the fees, the people who lay out the tables. There are lots of jobs. Well, everyone can do each other's jobs, and everyone else will do each other's jobs at a particular point. This is embedded in the functioning of the market itself. There's a circulation of jobs, a circulation of roles. That is, different people have different relationships with each other over time. And they can be in that, and be in it resiliently, and that's the way the market endures. But in some ways, these kinds of practices and logics have been in some ways appropriated by finance capital as a way in which to make those kinds of markets now expendable. Obsolescent in some ways. So the endurance of the modalities of the endurance of finance capital, increasingly important as a kind of underlining of urban economy, puts us in a different position. It puts us in a different kind of sense of what it means to be resilient and to endure. And increasingly our labor and our lives are in some ways expendable. And our thoughts expendable. As long as we're able to consume, as long as we're able to offer ourselves as though of people who have particular desires that can be addressed, you know, every time we like something, every time we go online, all the cookies in the world, we're being parsed, we're being divided into lots of different needs and lots of different desires. We're no longer one individual self anymore. We're multiple selves to different kinds of markets and to different kinds of surveillance and to different kinds of monitoring. But in some ways we're increasingly expendable even. So what does that mean in terms of our endurance? And that's why this kind of sense of this neoliberal sense of always having to change gears ourselves, you know, always going for that second or third MA, or always trying to sign up for that, you know, new beautician technician program, or always trying to sign up in this, or always on, you know, trying to have a different Instagram account where we're trying to sell something, or we're trying to find a niche for our, you know, advertise ourselves as a particular kind of. So all I'm saying is that the terms of endurance change because the modality of urban power also changes. And that modality is something which is much more resilient in terms of the kinds of mechanisms and practices and geographies in which it is involved in which it in some is able to in some ways reproduce itself. I mean, we're all in some ways precarious labor, you know. I've been working for 56 years. I've been in the job markets 56 years. And yeah, I mean, I've kind of established myself, but you know, when I really think about it, I'm not that far from the street, you know. If I don't continue to sort of try to invent some new way to do things, then you know, there's you younguns that come along much smarter than me, much more capable than me, and I'm, you know. So we live in a position where we're much, all of us much. I mean, I'm not trying to say we're all poor. That I'm not trying to say we're all precarious. But we're in some ways close to that situation.
When you wrote, you use in words spirits. You play with these words. You play with this word. What is your own definitions of this word?
Of which word?
Spirits.
Spirits.
She was reading the.
Oh, okay. Well, it's. I mean, several things. One aspect of the notion of spirits is what I would call the time of the maybe. Mm. And by the time of the maybe, I mean that, for example, you come to a checkpoint on the road. No matter how well prepared you are, no matter if you have something to hide or not, no matter if you're just an ordinary citizen or on the run or wanted or something, no matter how good your performance, no matter how well prepared you are, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get through that checkpoint. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. That is the sort of this the notion of no matter what you are, no matter how skilled you are, no matter how prepared you are for any task, it doesn't guarantee that you'll get through whatever you need to get through. So it's maybe you will, maybe you won't. And it's this notion of the maybe you won't or maybe you will, which is a spiritual moment. It is a matter of spirits, not a matter of accident, not a matter of arbitrary, but a matter of something is at work, which we can never really grasp, but it's there. It may have a body that we don't see, it may have a kind of liveliness that we don't see, and that's in some ways what the sense of spirit. But there are many connotations. I mean, in many aspects of urban life, it's where there's a great deal of competition for resources and for opportunities and for affordances. Where there's a great deal of envy in terms of who has what. Did you really deserve this? Why don't I deserve it? Why did you get it and I don't? Where there is a sense that there's only so much to go around. What is often on people's minds is a sense of you see, it's this sense of in those situations, I have to be open to the world. I can't be shut off, because if I'm shut off from the world, I miss a lot of different opportunities. But I also know that I'm opening myself up in a context in which there's very limited things to go around, and there are other people who might want what I want. And so that exposure is problematic in a way. And so there's a kind of anxiety of being exposed to the world, because when you're exposed to the world, you can be possessed. You open yourself up to the world. You're not defending against the outside. You're not defending against external information. You're not about other people's envy, about what people are. So literally, quite literally, what people have in mind is a kind of worry about being possessed by those other things. And those other things are sort of given the notion of spirit, to be possessed. You know, the way in which the kind of anxieties of households, of couples who can't really economically guarantee their future together. Oftentimes there's the notion of being possessed in the night by a night wife or a night husband, someone that comes from the outside and takes you and then determines what it is that you do and you think. The way in which, you know, you're at a bar and you always have to watch, you know, what you're drinking, because you don't want someone to. The way when your mouth is open, or you're, you know, or even in terms of sex, the way you're open to the world is the way you could be possessed. So people also call this spirits. Partly because it reflects the kind of dilemma of I need to be exposed, but yet I take an inordinate risk in being exposed, to in some ways be influenced, to be affected, to be interfered with by things that I can't control. And this is a major reality, day-to-day reality for many urban residents of the world. And then there's a sort of the notion of spirits again as these kinds of middle spaces, you know, that I was trying to talk about before. For example, the way in which the dilemma for many Black urban residents in different parts of the world is, on the one hand, if you're being included in the game, what is the price of that inclusion? The price of that inclusion is that sometimes you have to give up the kinds of ways of living that you've long cherished. I mean, look at in Detroit in the early part of the 1930s and 40s. Black residents of Detroit were given jobs in the automobile factories, were allowed to now become working class in the automobile factories, but only if they organized themselves into nuclear family households. Whereas before in Detroit amongst Black residents was replete with different forms of collective living, extended family living. People composing households out of many different kinds of, so they had to be included was excluding a kind of sense of defining the urban in a particular kind of way.
So they were obliged of that?
Huh?
They were obliged of this family structure?
Yeah, they were obliged because they had to move into single family houses where, and then, so what we can see this as exclusionary inclusion, and then we can also see this the being subjected to inclusionary exclusion, where that is being excluded is really being part of the game, because if you're excluded, you know, the way in which many Black urban residents are often considered as having extraordinary powers, that they're the ones who can do all these illicit things, these illicit economies, or that they can tell things that no one else can do. They become part of the game by virtue of being excluded. The way in which so many poor districts of cities, you know, they seem to be excluded from the main kind of life of the city, but, you know, all kinds of things are worked out there. You know, all kinds of financial deals, political deals, all kinds of things that can't be done on the books officially. So in some ways, what is the space between inclusionary exclusion and exclusionary inclusion? What's that sort of, that no space in between? And that space within many different kinds of urban cultures is considered the space of spirits. Of jinn, of that which mediates those seemingly paradoxical worlds, that occupies the city with its ability to make seeming contradictions and paradoxes sort of live with each other.
So it's like a line who make a difference.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then it's also a kind of, you know. When Sylvia Winter, the sort of Black Caribbean philosopher, theorist, talks about the need for a new ceremony, a new kind of sense of what it means to be human, she talks about the notion of spirit as a kind of different kind of semiology. That is a semiology that's not in some sense dependent upon the normative language that we know it. But the ways in which the sign systems, the different sign systems that happen within nature, outside of man, the ways in which non-human entities communicate with each other, also become part of a kind of broader sense of language, which he would call spirit. So the spirit is not something here nebulous, but a spirit refers to the ways in which entities communicate with each other. The way the landscape looks, the way that animals leave their traces, the way that different animals communicate with each other. The kinds of messages that are sent back and forth between different kinds of, that is not our formal linguistic system. Well, in some ways the urban is a kind of extended language system which we don't often recognize. I mean, take a few city blocks and think about everything that takes place at the same time. Everything that takes place in the same time. In all the kitchens, in all the living rooms, in all the cars passing by, in all the ways in which, with all the machines and the stereos that are turned on and the TVs and the water taps and the light switches. This is all about, if you take up this simultaneously, this is all an extended system of signals, of communications, of signs responding to each other. I mean, it's maybe too much for us to grasp at any particular moment. We only think about what's going on in our kitchen. It's more than enough for us. But if you think the simultaneity of all the events amongst all the entities that take place within a kind of urban system, It's an immense kind of sign system. And so the way in which, sometimes the only way that we can come to grips with this is to think about it as a kind of spiritual, a matter of spirits. Because it's too difficult to disentangle. It's too difficult to say noun, verb, adjective, we can't make sentences out of it. And so this is also some sense of the urban spirits. Mm.
But the urban spirits can be the clock, no? Who defines what happens at which time? Like in the natural space, sun and the moon.
Yeah. Mm. No, I don't want to not pin it down to, there's we can keep going and talking about the, but I think increasingly there is a, I mean, it's different. I mean, there is, within many cities, the way in which more and more people's time is devoted to so-called spiritual activities. But I'm not sure whether or not that really, I don't want to rule it out. I mean, I don't want to rule it out about Pentecostals going to prayer meetings every night of the week. I don't want to rule out Pentecostals receiving the Holy Spirit, I don't want to rule that out about spirits, but that's not really what I have in mind.
We have a break, or we've been on for almost 2 hours.
What?
Ça fait 2 heures qu'on parle.
No.
Si, really? Presque 2 heures.
Really?
Really?
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to.
You want to have a break?
Sure, whatever you want to do. Yeah.
On fait une pause ou on continue un peu?
Oui.
Okay. Let's have a break. Mm-hmm.